Our second lesson is Exodus 3. It will not surprise you to hear what it's about. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, "I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up." When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." He said further, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, "I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings. And I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppressed them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" He said, "I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain." But Moses said to God, "If I come to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your ancestors has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" Friends, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So now that I have your attention with the baptismal font that is burning and not consumed, the not consumed part is really important. We need to catch up on everything that's happening in Exodus, because this story happens over a really long time period that we sometimes forget. Just last week, we were dealing with Jacob. We've skipped over all of Jacob's kids and how they got down to Egypt. So Jacob has 12 boys and some girls. They sell Joseph into slavery. He comes down. He rises to prominence and power as an advisor to Pharaoh. There's a famine. His family moves back down. He is really kind of mean to his siblings and connives to get the whole family back down there by getting them arrested, essentially. And then we come to Exodus. Now, it starts off that there's a new Pharaoh who did not know Joseph. It's been about 400 years, the scholars think. So it's just been a day or two. And the people of Egypt have forgotten the good that Joseph did, but that also probably means that the people of Israel have forgotten who Joseph was and why he was important. So at the start of this, we get the narrative that the Israelites have fallen from prominence to become manual labor and slaves. And they are viewed as a threat to the Pharaoh and to Egypt. And now they are oppressed. And it's hard work, and they cry out to God. And there is no indication in chapter 1 that God has even heard them. They just cry out. They build cities and things, and they work really hard. And they are put to work really hard. All because Pharaoh is afraid that there are so many of them that they will take over and displace them or fight with the enemy. It is the standard us and them story. Them is dangerous. But in this story, the us is the them. The people of God are the ones who are dangerous and threatening. So Pharaoh eventually decides that there are too many Hebrews. So he's going to whittle down the number of Hebrews. And he's going to do that by killing all the baby boys. To me, this is not Pharaoh's smartest decision. This is his labor force. And he's deciding he's essentially going to have no men in 15 years. I know you're not surprised to see a politician make a stupid, short-sighted decision. But then we introduce the midwives. Because Pharaoh goes to the midwives and says, you know, all the boys were supposed to get tossed into the Nile, yet there's boys everywhere. And they look at me, these Hebrew women, they just pop babies out right like that. And God deals well with the midwives. And then we run into a woman who has a baby boy. And she isn't sure what to do with him. She keeps him hidden and secret for about 3 months. And then she games the system. She creates a basket, and she lines it with pitch to make it watertight. And she puts the baby in it and casts it on the Nile, which is technically what Pharaoh said you had to do. You had to throw the babies in the Nile. The fact that he's on a yacht equivalent basket. There's a word that you need to hear. In the Hebrew, the word used here in Exodus for basket occurs only one other place in the entire Old Testament. Now, rack your brains for all the places where you could come up with basket. Right? There's not a ton of basket stories. It's the same word they use for ark in Noah's ark. Something that floats on the water that will save the people. There's something going on there to only use that word in those two places. The basket floats down the river. It is found by Pharaoh's daughter and brought out, and she decides to raise the child as her own. And one of Pharaoh's daughter's handmaidens, or somebody who is watching, happens to be the baby's sister, and she says, would you like me to get a wet nurse for that? And so Moses' mother, so named because he was drawn out of the water, is his nurse and is in the house of Pharaoh that an Israelite baby is raised. This will ultimately come back to bite Pharaoh in the tuchus. Right? Because we've read the rest of the story, we know how this goes. That this child is going to be a real problem. Now, between that in chapter 2 and chapter 3, Moses grows up. He becomes sort of an adult. He's a hot-tempered young man in there. He kills someone in between, and he runs away to Midian where he gets married. And that's where we find ourselves at the start of chapter 3, is that Moses is in Midian with his father-in-law's flocks. Do you understand how much time has already passed from chapter 1 when Moses is not even in the story or born to when he is old enough to have a father-in-law? This isn't happening quickly, is it? Imagine that you're one of the Hebrews who is mightily oppressed by God and you've cried out, and here we are, let's say 18, 20 years later, and we're going, well, is his voicemail full? Is it even set up? Is there anybody up there? Because it's been 20 years. And then Moses is out keeping the sheep and he sees something distracting as only something on fire can be. particularly if it's where it's not supposed to be on fire. And he goes over and approaches the bush. And it's interesting because in Exodus it tells us that God only speaks after Moses approaches. It's not that the burning bush is out there in the yard and it's yelling at everybody who goes by in Carbon and Westminster. It's that it's waiting for somebody to park and pull in and walk up. And then, as Silas has accosted me several times since Sunday school, the bush says, "Take off your shoes, you're on holy ground." And Moses almost quite literally has a come to Jesus session. God says to Moses, "You're going to go back and you're going to get my people because I've heard my people. I've heard my people cry out. I've witnessed their oppression." And Moses, I think, is looking around for the other person that God is talking to. "Oh, you said Mr. Moses. That's my father-in-law. I can go back and get him if you'd like." And God doesn't let him off the hook that easily, does God? And this is one of two or three or four times when Moses is going to try to get out of this job. He says, "Who, me?" He says, "Who shall I say has sent me?" That's where we get the famous piece with the name of God. And that's right where our passage cuts off this week. What struck me this week is how long this takes. This is a really slowly developing story. I mean, Moses has time to be born, time to be thrown into the river, time to be drawn from the river, time to be adopted by Pharaoh's household, time to grow up into a rash, impetuous young man who kills somebody, time to run away, time to get married, and time to establish himself in another land with a day job. When I pray, I want response a lot faster than that. And my prayers aren't like the Hebrews' prayers in Egypt. I'm not struggling and suffering and oppressed like that. And I'm still impatient. And I'm probably not the only one in the room who's still impatient, am I? Do we understand the scale and scope at which God is operating here? The people in power in Egypt have forgotten Joseph. Now, we like the story of Joseph. We make it into Broadway plays. We like the story of Joseph. It sticks around for us. But for Egypt and Pharaoh, that story has already faded away. It has probably faded away for Moses, too. You notice that the name God gives him is, "I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob," and Joseph is not mentioned. So, do they know this God that they have cried out to? Do they know how this God might do things? My experience is when we ask God for something, God gives it to us, but not anywhere close to the manner in which we expected to get it. The people who cried out, who wanted to be set free, who wanted to be delivered. Now, God has told Moses, right? That you're going to go in and you're going to get to say to Pharaoh, "Let my people go." And it's just that simple, right? You guys have read ahead. You know that it's just that simple. Moses walks right in. He says, "I'm tearing up the contracts. We're out of here." And Pharaoh just lets them go, right? And they're immediately going to get to a land flowing with milk and honey. And those Jebusites, Hivites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, and Jebusites are just going to let them move in, right? It's just a short trip down the block. Oh, well, that's kind of disappointing, isn't it? I thought God was going to do this. It would be easy and not demanding on me or us. Right? I mean, God's just going to make this happen and it's going to be all better because we prayed for it, right? Well, first of all, we've already been waiting for 20 years. And then Moses is going to go back to Pharaoh and he's going to say, "Let my people go." And Pharaoh's going to go, "Who are you? And why would I even think about doing this?" And it's going to take 10 approaches to get Pharaoh to let the people go. 10. And after every approach, there's kind of it's kind of the carrot and the stick thing. Moses said, "You could let us go." And Pharaoh goes, "I don't think so." And God goes, "Whack." And even after Pharaoh says, "Get them out of here," the army goes after them. The good thing is that they don't really spend any time in the wilderness before they get to the land flowing with milk and honey. Isn't that great? I mean, you guys all talk like 40 is nothing. So then they spend 40 years in the wilderness. Moses is going to die before they get to the promised land. This story encompasses the entirety of Moses' life, from his birth to his death and everything in between, and they still don't get there. It's a really depressing thing to think about as a minister. We have the choice. This can be a very depressing thing. You can pour your whole life into really just this one thing. All we were doing is moving the Hebrews from Egypt to the promised land. Little teeny tiny insignificant thing in the Bible, right? And can't even get that done. Or Moses doesn't get it done. God still does. The scope of what God is doing is more than what we handle things on. I think we get that on a very intellectual, distant, out there sort of level, that God does things we don't understand on scales we don't understand. Are we willing to pour our whole life into it and still not get there? And that's ultimately the challenge of being a leader like Moses, is are you willing to pour your whole life into it and still not make it? And to both hope and trust and believe that the journey will continue after you. That eventually you'll get there. Eventually they do get there. There's all sorts of problems when they get there. That probably really wouldn't be a surprise to Moses. Are we willing to consider that God is working on a scale beyond us? But that somebody's still got to go talk to Pharaoh. And not talk to Pharaoh once, but talk to Pharaoh 10 or 11 times. And then not just convince Pharaoh, but when you're out there in the wilderness, convince the people again and again and again that you are not going to turn this Exodus around and head back to Egypt. this delivery of the people of God is the exact opposite of the delivery the midwives describe. The midwives describe a quick, quick delivery. This one is not a quick, quick delivery. It takes a really, really long time. Are we willing to be in it for the long haul and not get there, not see the finish? Our attention may be grabbed, right? By a burning bush at the side of the road that makes us veer off and go see. Are we then willing to continue down the road that that stop has put us on? Moses tries to get off that road multiple times. He's ready to be done with this whole thing. I don't talk so good in public. It's okay, you've got Aaron. You know, why would they even listen to me? I'll make them listen. This passage, with the last two and the next weeks, are about us understanding how long it takes to be the faithful people of God. It doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen on a weekend trip. It doesn't happen on a weekend retreat. Being the faithful people of God is a journey from slavery and oppression to wandering and wilderness to a land of promise. Are you willing to pour your whole life into the trip, even if you don't make it to the end? To God alone be the glory today and forever. Amen.